Meeting will come to order. We don't have a quorum present, but we have no action items. So we're today is a welcome and introduction for a number of people, and we also have a number of resources in the folder. And one particular one I'll call your attention to. There is a sheet that has everybody's picture. There are new people that you aren't familiar with, but there's a little red card that has all staff and research and fiscal staff and so forth with names and phone numbers. This one you might actually want to take back to your office so that it can be there for a resource for you. We'll just begin by calling attention to the fact we'll let them introduce themselves later, but Bev Scalzi has been appointed vice chair for our committee, and Kathy Finkelstad, our ranking minority member. If you happen to notice the names on this card and see this front table, we may be the only committee like this, and there was no plan. We didn't recruit people, but it seems in this committee that girls rule. So it was a total coincidence, and as those things go. We should also point out that this room is not able to televise committees, and so when occasionally we have one that we think warrants being televised, we may be switching rooms, and we actually have an upcoming meeting where that happens. Phyllis Kahn has agreed to switch with us. So it just means that when you get these meetings on your agenda, just make sure that you have noted the room number. So staff introductions, first of all, we are very lucky because we have two committee staff who have a lot of experience here, and I'll let them tell you what that is. Lori Nissel, who is our committee legislative assistant, can tell you her background.
I've been here all of my adult life. I've been a committee legislative assistant for 16 years. I've had appropriations, agriculture, K-12 finance, state government finance, and judiciary. And now I get capital investments, so I'm very excited about that.
And Jenny Nash, our committee administrator.
I have not been here quite as long as Lori, but a little over 20 years. Started as a page, Higher Education Division of Appropriations, also the full appropriations when Lori was the committee administrator. I've worked in constituent services, CFL Media. I was in the Senate for a few years, and now here we are.
And our two House research staff, Deb Dyson and Kathy Novak, Kathy specifically on higher ed, and if you would just briefly give your history with the committee, and you might even mention the handout you have in the...
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Deb Dyson from House Research, the nonpartisan research and legal services office for the House. I've been with Capital Investment Committee since 2000, so this will be my seventh year with this particular subject area. I've been with the House since 1991, one session with Judiciary Committee, and then after that, Local Government, Metropolitan Affairs, and dabbled in various other subject areas. So.
And Deb has a handout in your file that gives you some overview information, and both she and Kathy will be, over time, giving us a bit of additional. Kathy.
I'm Kathy Novak. I'm also with the House Research Department, and I've been with the House also since 1991. And my other areas that I work in are higher education, so that makes sense to follow the bonding appropriations for higher education, and also the Ways and Means and the Finance Committee, the state budget.
And then our House Fiscal Staff, Corinne Zewers.
Corinne Zewers, and I am the Fiscal Analyst for Transportation and Capital Investment, and this is my first session. And previously, I worked for the Governor's Workforce Development Council.
And then our caucus staff, Dan Kane is still with us today, but this may be the one and only meeting, I believe, Dan, because starting next week, a new person, Laura Sales, will be serving the committee. Is that your... Okay. So we'll see. And did you hear that first name? Laura Sales will be our And then, of course, this wonderful pleasure I have, GOP research consultant Larissa Paltola, who she and I have spent lots of time together in the last few years. Larissa, a brief introduction.
Hi, I'm Larissa Paltola. I'm the former CA for Capital Investment the last 2 years, and I've been here at the caucus for over 5 years.
And then our committee page is temporary. We only have him today, Dave Reisenen, and then I believe permanent. And then next week, apparently, we have permanent pages assigned to us. Yeah, hopefully. we, of course, have the commissioner, but if we have enough members to just do a quick go-around of your district and maybe if you're new to the committee. Kathy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kathy Tinglestead from District 49B in Anoka County, the cities of Coon Rapids and Andover, and this will be my seventh year on this committee.
Lynn Carlson, I wasn't sure what you meant by new to the committee. I was on the Capital Investment Committee from the time that was first created until about 8 years ago, and then something happened, so I've been on a temporary leave of absence from the committee, but I'm back.
We'll just back up briefly, Gene. I represent Claude.
John Burns, and I'm from District 33B, Western Hennepin County, and I'm very proud to be, I think, the only freshman on the committee, so happy to be here.
I'm Maury Lanning from District 9A, Moorhead in Northern Clay County, and this is my third term, first term on the Capital Investment Committee.
I'm Matt Dean from District 52B in Northern Washington County. I was on the committee last time and racked up a lot of miles all over the state and enjoyed it, and I look forward to working with returning vets. And to you, Madam Chair, I'm assuming that your mode of transportation on the tours will be the same as the last committee chair, or are you not going to use a motorcycle?
I'll have to go out and make a purchase. unless someone in the audience will loan me theirs.
Dean Erdahl, I represent District 18B, which is Meeker County, six townships in Wright County, Greenleaf Lake. I've served on the committee my first 2 years, legislature, 2002 I was elected, and the last 2 years I was not, but I'm back again and eager to work with such a fine chair and group. Thank you.
Hi, Jean Wagenius. I represent the far south of Minneapolis, generally between Diamond Lake and Lake Nokomis. This is my first time on the committee. Glad to be here.
Maybe we'll
Bev Scalzi, and I represent District 54B, which is a group of five cities just north of the capital, about 7 miles, all in Ramsey County, and they're Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, Gem Lake, Southern Shoreview, and Eastern Roseville, and I'm very glad to be here.
I'm Bernie Leader, and I'm glad to be back on the committee, too, and with Representative Hausman. I had the opportunity, well, I should say, the easiest thing to say, I'm between North Dakota and Manitoba. That's where I'm up there, in the far corner of the state. But I had the opportunity working 7 years with the research Deborah Dyson. So that was, we were involved in trying to relocate the Metropolitan Airport for about 7 years. And it went,
I'm Neil Peterson. I'm from, as I say, I'm from Bloomington and enough Edina to keep me humble. This is my second time on the bonding committee, and I think when I would react to people the last couple of years and they'd ask me how it went, the bonding committee and the tours were really the highlight of my legislative experience last year. So, looking forward to it again.
I'm Rick Hansen. I represent Northern Dakota County. I'm in my second term, and this is my first term on the Bonding Capital Investment Committee.
Larry House, Walker, Minnesota. I represent Cass, Crow, and Hubbard counties, and this will be my third term on Capital Investment.
Representative
Solbright. Oh, sorry I'm late. Madam Chair, I'm representing Lawrence Solbright, District 3B, which is part of Itasca County and all of Aiken County. live in Grand Rapids. District 3B is half of District 3. District Center District 3 runs from the middle of Mille Lacs Lake up to and including the northwest angle. So I'm half of the size of Connecticut, or Rhode Island, I guess. Been on this committee several times and look forward to another successful year.
Are we introducing ourselves?
You're it.
Oh, all right. My colleague over there from the North Woods has half the size of Connecticut. I think mine's about a mile and a half square. And I can walk mine in as much time as it takes for him to get out of his driveway. I'm Representative Tim Mahoney, and I represent the east side of St. Paul. I have a couple of golf courses in it. I have one of the largest parks in the metro area in the district. Not quite as large as our Chairs Park. I'm serving my fifth term and third term on bonding. So I am looking forward to having a good year and making the state a better place by the time we're done.
And we're very fortunate to have at our first meeting the Finance Commissioner, Tom Hansen, also relatively new to his job, to speak to us, and then he has staff members to introduce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to be here and will show up anytime you want me to. It is my favorite subject of any I've ever worked with is capital investment. I think it has always been a fairly collaborative and bipartisan process. At least it has the last 2 years at a time when the legislature was fairly a fairly acrimonious place. The capital investment was an example of how we can all work together in a bipartisan manner, and I hope we can continue to do that in this year and next year. The other thing I wanted to point out before I turn it over to Jane and Peter is we will have some recommendations coming out on Monday. I would love to tell you, but I have to wait. They will fall under the purview of this committee. If you remember from the February forecast, the forecast assumes a $135 million bonding bill for the off-bonding year. We will be somewhat below that, focusing on emergency items as we interpret them. You may have a different interpretation, and we'll work with you on that. And then items of past, what we call items of past consensus. So you will see that on Monday, and I can come back and talk to you about those. The one difficulty that we found when we were putting the governor's budget together is when you get to the bonding projects in a non-bonding year, there are some big dollar amounts out there, and not knowing what the rest of the projects are for next year, you don't want to box yourselves. We didn't want to box ourselves in, not knowing what we were going to see as requests this summer. So that's something we're going to want to keep in mind. We have a 3% debt limit in this state, and it's below $1 billion. Maybe that'll change for next year, but we want to make sure that we don't box ourselves in for next year. That is, and the only other comment I wanted to make, and Peter will cover it, or we'll talk about it as this committee goes forward. Debt service in the budget is the fastest growing area, and it will. Peter has a chart, and he gave it to me, and I looked at it before I came, and I don't know if it's in his presentation, but it should probably within the next few years exceed $1 billion of general fund money in a biennium, which exceeds the cost of the bonding bills. So at some point, our capital investment bills and our projects start eating into the projects, or he starts eating into those things, other things we want to do in the budget over time, be it more money for education or health care. So that's another thing I hope we can look at while meeting the needs of the state. And Madam Chair, that's all I had planned on saying. I don't know if anybody had any questions, or we can.
And we have scheduled the governor's proposal on January 30th, and I believe the commissioner will come back at that time to make that presentation. But if you have any questions of the commissioner right now before. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, just a quick one. When you said it's the fastest growing area in the state budget, are highway projects included in that when you make that statement?
I think that they're not. Peter's saying no. But that is also, I think that's, if you were to factor that in, it probably would be.
Okay. I was just interested because there has been the policy of the administration to fund highways with debt bonding.
We've contributed to it, too. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But regardless of the gross number on the question, the debt service will exceed $1 billion just on the bonding piece.
Yeah, the general obligation bond.
Bonds is going to ratchet into a point that dollar amount will actually exceed what we've ever done in bonding.
Yes.
It's a new era.
Or what we've done in general obligation.
In general obligation.
Yes.
Representative Singleton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Hansen, I'm wondering if you could just give your opinion on, based on the history we've had the last couple of years with capital investment, with having two large bonding bills 2 years in a row, how that might have played into any decision-making that you're looking at for the governor's recommendation for this year's bonding bill?
Commissioner.
I think that it gets back to what I said a minute ago, that we tried to limit the off year to those items we thought were legitimate emergencies and things that couldn't wait until we get here next year. We didn't go, as you'll notice on Monday, we didn't go as high as what was in the forecast. The committee may feel that there are other things that meet that emergency definition. We kept it fairly restrictive. So it impacted us in that we were a little more cautious this year, knowing the pressure that'll probably come next year. And we want to, I like to see the whole buffet before I look at everything before I go and start picking the food off. So,
thank you. Other questions?
One more comment. We're not going to set, I think our first year we ended up setting a concrete dollar amount. And we're not going to do that this year. If there's something you think is an emergency, and you have a different definition and you want to include some things, we always figure it out in the end. So,
thank you very much. And we're then going to be joined by Peter Salson and Jane Rankin, I believe. And we will see you again the end of the month. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, you have this in your packet.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Jane Rankin with the Department of Finance. I am an executive budget officer at Finance, assigned to the higher education area, and I'm also the capital budget coordinator for Finance. And what Commissioner Hansen talked about as far as the governor's bonding recommendations that will be coming out next week, he kind of stole my presentation, the introduction to this presentation, but in some ways it doesn't really matter because what I am going to talk through and walk you through is the process that will lead up to the governor's bonding recommendations for next session for the 2008 bonding bill. Because in some ways, your committee, that whole process will start for you this spring and carry on then into the summer and fall until his recommendations are released January of 2008. So this presentation, I see you've all found it's the one with the blue cover. It's what I'll be working through. And for the benefit of folks who haven't been on the committee before, it sounds like most of you have had some experience with bonding, but I'm starting with a real basic level, which is that the capital budget process at Finance is guided by two statutes in Chapter 16A, which is the chapter of Minnesota statutes that relates to the Department of Finance. The first place to start is in 16A11, which talks about sending the governor's budget to the legislature. There is a particular subdivision in here. There's a sentence that talks about capital budget recommendations and then a little more detail in a subdivision. The key ideas in this provision are that, one, the capital budget has a six-year horizon. That's a little different than the operating budget, which you're setting operating budget appropriations for 2 years, and we also look at the next 2 years of tails, but we don't go much beyond that four-year horizon. In the capital area, we are much more looking at a longer-term strategic direction for the state, and that's why it has a six-year horizon. The other key point I want to make in this statute is just that when the governor's budget submission comes out, he is required to show an agency's requested project in the priority order that the agency has specified. So it's one indication, and there are others, I think, throughout the capital budget process that just support the idea, the view that in capital budgeting, it's much more of a it's much more of an even sort of common area for the governor and legislature. I guess the phrase I was looking for is you're on more of an even footing between the governor and the legislature when it comes to the information that you're getting about the projects and the decisions that you end up making. At the most basic level, then, the Department of Finance's role in all of this is to reorganize the information on all the requested projects for the benefit of the governor and the legislature, and we also provide assistance to the governor to do his decision-making when he's putting his package together. The other statute that I want to mention relates specifically to bonding requests from local government. And the key ideas in this particular statute is, one, that when a local government comes and asks for a bonding project, that there's an expectation of a local match. The statute actually talks about 50% as being the expected level of match, but the statute leaves enough leeway to deal with individual circumstances. The other ideas in this particular statute are that all the submitted requests are sent on to the legislature. And last year, which is the first year I was the capital budget coordinator, we got 119 project requests from local governments. And so we collected them all and put them all, and they were included in the budget document.
Representative Colbert.
And Chair.
And they do, members, they do suggest that we just ask questions as we go along. And if you have noticed, we believe this will carry over to the next meeting as well. So they will probably not conclude depending on the number of questions, but that their preference is to have you ask them as you go along. Representative Solberg.
Jane, just one quick question on that, if you could. How do you notify local governments the process of submitting the request? Sometimes local governments will come to us as legislators and say, here's a good project, we want you to introduce a bill, and we have the right to do that. We're elected officials. But sometimes it becomes more difficult when local governments haven't at least gone through this process of evaluation. How does the department notify the local units of government?
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, you'll see some slides on this a little further on, but basically the answer is in April we will be posting instructions on capital budget requests for both agencies, and then we'll have a special section for local governments. So if a local government comes to you and asks you about how to submit a project, you can just refer them to the Department of Finance website come April, and I will certainly can let the committee know when we do get those instructions posted, so you know that it's open for business.
Madam Chair, is that the only mechanism you have for informing local units of government? Do you work through Minnesota League, stuff, cities, or other entities?
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, we don't have any other formal mechanism other than the posting on the website. I certainly would be interested in talking with members about other avenues to get the word out. Because, as I said, this is only now my second time through of doing this job. So,
Madam Chair, just let me encourage you to have a conversation with organizations such as the League of Minnesota Cities and others to help you with that township. Okay. Thank you, Madam.
Madam Chair, Representative Silberg, I'll make a note of that. That's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
So as I've alluded to, the process will begin this spring when we, at the Department of Finance, issue capital budget instructions. I'm hoping to shoot for April. It may slide into early May. The schedule that we use at the Department of Finance is set basically by working backwards from the two dates that are specified in statute. The first and most important date is that the governor's 2008 recommendations will be due to the legislature by January 15th. And the other date that's in statute is that preliminary state agency capital requests and complete requests from local governments are due to the legislature by July 15th of this year. And the July 15th date is the one that provides the legislative committees with the list of projects and the contact names so that the committees can then start planning schedules for tours. Executive branch staff also will do site visits of selected projects.
Someone who was in my office this week thought that July 15th had been changed to June 15th. Or is that a different deadline?
Madam Chair and members, it's the other way around. In statute previously, the date for agency submissions had been July 1, and effectively at finance, we needed to get things in to us a little before that date, so we had set a June 15th date. But we had heard from agencies that was a little bit of a time crunch because they were still coming off the end of the operating budget setting and would have appreciated more time. Local governments there used to be two dates in statute for them. And again, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. You'll see this information on a later slide. Local governments had two dates, one of the July 1st, I think it was, or maybe the June 15th. And then another one later in the fall. And what we at finance found is that having two dates for local government submissions didn't really help get any better information on the project, and it led to a lot of confusion, honestly, on the part of the local governments. There was a lot of concern about somebody having missed the deadline and not being able to have their project considered.
Representative Singleton, questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to this point, and I'm remembering past summers with capital investment, I think with the earlier date we did some of our site visits a little earlier, so I'm sure we'll be talking about this later on, but that sounds like it will maybe delay the site visits for committee members into later in the summer and in the fall perhaps. Then.
It does seem as though we might have to rethink our timetable.
Madam Chair and Representative Tinglestad, it is a two-week difference. So,
Thank you.
Christine. So when July 15th, when we make our submission to you, as far as agency requests, at that time it's primarily a list of potential projects and in priority order. then agencies are spending the summer and into the fall developing additional information about their project requests. They are developing, we ask them for an agency-wide strategic capital plan, and this is another element that points at that six-year time horizon for the capital budget. We're asking them for project-specific information so that we get a better understanding of what the project is, and we're asking for cost information that is sorted into specified categories, and if it's construction, we are looking at, we are expecting that their construction costs would be escalated according to a schedule that we provide. The next couple slides I have are just really examples of documents that you will see when we do the budget submission. This is, I just picked a short example from last year from Military Affairs. This project funding summary is basically what will be submitted to you in July. A list of projects, priority orders, dollar amounts. At Finance, we don't expect these dollar amounts to be final at this point. Then we have, you won't see this in July, but in the final submission there will be a strategic planning summary from every agency. And then for every project, a project narrative with contact names. And then finally the project detail page that lays out the costs sorted, as I mentioned, into the categories that we specify. I talked quickly about construction projects having an escalation factor. That, in other words, that's inflation. We expect construction projects to have inflation included in the estimates. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about this to make a distinction in capital budgeting. We're interested in making sure that a selected project gets built, can be built. It doesn't really benefit a state agency, but it doesn't benefit the state if an agency is unable to complete a project because they haven't taken escalation of the cost of construction materials into account throughout the project schedule. Construction inflation isn't really the same kind of scalable assumption that, for example, the consumer price index measure of general inflation is. On this particular example, if you can see the screen, oh, that's pretty good detail. You'll notice that the inflation line here is zero. And perhaps I didn't choose the best example here, but it lets me mention that as far as accounting for inflation in a project at the Department of Finance, we don't want and don't expect to see inflation included when it's a sort of a program, a bonding program like this one, where Military Affairs would be given a set amount of money. They've got a list of projects you saw on an earlier slide, so they would be expected to manage their list of projects within the allocated money. That's a little bit different than a situation where the legislature has authorized money to build a particular facility, where clearly then you want to make sure that you've got the entire cost of the building covered up front. I have, the next slide is a example of the kind of inflation schedule that we post and have agencies and also local governments. We, if they're doing a construction project, we would expect them to go ahead and inflate their costs according to the schedule we provide. This is from last year, and we will be updating this and posting it, publishing it for 2008. The days of relatively small increases in construction costs are behind us, I am told, from the experts that Finance uses to develop this schedule. We're in a period where there's just generally a higher amount of increase in construction costs. So that's just something that we want to make sure we're taking into account when we're developing project lists for the bonding bills coming up. Now I want to spend a little bit more time talking about the local government capital requests. And here's a little bit of history on the date change. As I mentioned earlier, there used to be two dates where we expected a preliminary submission and then a final one by November. And we just didn't find that wasn't getting us enough additional information to offset the confusion and extra work that it was taking to communicate all these dates and requirements to the local governments. And we also found, honestly, that for some particular local projects, the information for the project would keep changing, so that by the time you got to legislative session and the bill was introduced, it was a different scope or a different number or something like that. So that argues for only having one submission date. As the capital budget coordinator, I have found that one of the main areas that I end up working in is with these local government requests. I am essentially the state contact for local governments who are requesting a bonding project. And what I end up doing is looking at their submissions. I'll talk to them about the kind of information that we're looking for. Some of the information that we need at finance is essentially the same as we're getting from agencies. So we want project narratives, we want cost information, we want to know their priorities. But there are also some other things that are unique to local governments. For example, we are looking for a resolution of support from the governing body, and that's a way for us to gauge the level of support and interest on the part of the local government for the particular project. We're looking for funding information for them. In particular, we spend a lot of time teasing out and gathering information on what their non-state funding sources are for a particular project. And then another key thing we're looking for is to make sure that the local project meets the requirements for general obligation bond financing. And on that last point, I'm going to ask you to wait and hold questions for Peter's presentation, because that ties much more directly to what he's going to talk about.
Representative Jockey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume when you're talking about local government requests, you're talking about requests that are outside of requests that are already within an agency request, public facilities for sewer and water, DNR trails. If they're working on a regional trail within the city with DNR, they're not expected to put in a separate request from what an agency is.
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, thank you for bringing that up. You are right, and that is a point that I should be making, and I'm glad you're giving me this opportunity. There are agencies that have bonding programs that a local government can apply to receive a grant through the bonding program. And the Public Facilities Authority, PFA, is a very good example of that, as is DNR. They have several programs. And in a situation like that, if the local, to back up, first of all, you're right that the Department of Finance doesn't want duplicate requests. If I get one from a local government that makes it look like they're really intending to apply for a grant through a program that's run by an agency, I will contact that agency and make sure that the local government's request gets connected into the right place in the agency. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the other element of my job as capital budget coordinator, in the statute that talks about local government bonding projects, there's a requirement that the Commissioner of Finance evaluates all of the requests from political subdivisions, and it lays out elements of what the evaluation has to cover. And that one of my jobs is to coordinate the evaluations that we're doing at Finance. I'm not doing them all myself. I rely very much on my colleagues, other executive budget officers, and other agency analysts to help understand and give context to the projects. But we have a requirement that we have to do this evaluation, and so my job is to make sure that we get it done. So that when the local government requests are submitted to the legislature.
Representative Guinness?
Yes, if you don't mind.
On the previous slide?
Yes, on the previous slide, on number five, you say the project will not expand the state's role in a new policy area. That tells me that we will be stuck in the past forever. Why are, for a governor who wanted us to move forward and to look forward and presented a vision of the future that is very different from the past, would we be carrying a something that says no change?
Ms. Rankin, that's number five. Project will not expand the state's role in a new policy area.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius. I don't have an answer directly to your point. I would say that many of these elements that are laid out in this statute are not black and white. They are important, though, because they are getting at factors and elements that I think the way I look at the statute is that it's trying to bring to the governor and legislators' attention the elements of the project. It's up to you, of course, to the governor. He has first crack at balancing the different requests and taking a statewide perspective and tying them to policy directions. But then that's also something, as you all know, that's something that you do, and that's your job. And the way I look at this statute is that the Department of Finance, the statute here is just recognizing that there are these different elements and factors that should be considered when you're developing a list of recommendations and when you're developing a final list of projects that you want to authorize bonding for.
And Representative Wagenius is probably conscious of the fact that federal programs are often solved first at the state level, that innovation happens there and moves federally. Maybe what you're suggesting that the same is true on the state level, that sometimes innovation and problem solving happens easier on the local level and then replicates?
Well, I would hope not, Madam Chair. I would hope that we would have opportunities both from the local level and from the state level, and that does seem to be language that constrains us to the past, and I would hope that the committee could visit that language.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, to finish then on the local government capital requests, all of the requests that Finance receives will be forwarded to the legislature by that January 15th deadline. Typically what we do is we present that information in the same format as the state agency projects, and I had an example of what those pages look like earlier in the slides. We usually group all of the requests in one section of the capital budget document called grants to political subdivisions. And included in the information will be a table that has the results of the finance department's evaluation of those local requests, including both item 5 and every other item on that list, Representative Lagunia. So that is all I wanted to say about the even year bonding process, budgeting process. And then I have a quick slide here. Commissioner Hansen went over all of this in his fashion in his remarks to the committee, but we ask, typically in the off year, we will ask agencies to notify finance if they have a capital request that can't wait until the regular bonding year, and we work with the agencies to get information about the project and make sure their cost estimates are up to date. We don't use the capital budget forms, and we don't produce a capital budget book. I would expect that next week you'll see a list of projects and that we will have bill language available pretty quickly after that, that will have the more specifics about the particular aspects of the projects that he's recommending. After a bonding bill is enacted, the budget division at finance gets involved in some of the implementation aspects of it. One of the things that EBO's executive budget officers do is we approve the appropriation accounts that get set up in the state's accounting system, MAPS. One of the things budget officers do is ensure that a conditional appropriation is, it gets set up and then it's immediately deactivated. And this would be a situation where there's something in the law that says something has to happen before the appropriation is released. The most common one I can think of is that there's a requirement that a local match be provided. And we have to have documentation that, yes, indeed, the local match has been provided before we will activate the account and allow the possibility that that appropriation gets spent on the project. It's not always local match, though. I remember I ran into one where there needed to be an agreement arrived at between two parties. And once that agreement was developed and signed, I had to get a copy of it and look it over and verify that it had been agreed to, and then I could activate the appropriation. Another element of the kind of review that we do at the finance department is there is a statute about non-state commitments to capital projects. This is a relatively new statute, and I don't think I have it. No, I don't have it in the presentation. It basically is another way to get at ensuring that a project has all of the funding sources it's going to need to get built before the state appropriation is released. And finance will be certifying that when that condition is met and appropriation is activated. There are some connections between the capital budget side of or functions at finance and the debt management functions at finance that Peter Sousen heads up. And I've put together a quick list of some of these areas. The first one is the amount of debt service carried in the forecast. Another one is bondability questions about whether GO bonds can be used to pay for a project. Often they first surface in the capital budget submission, and then I end up discussing it with Peter Sousen.
And Mr. Sousen, you're going to be talking more about that bondability issue.
Yes, I am.
Peter and I also we work together on implementation issues that come up sometimes after enactment. Special cases also we will discuss with the Attorney General. We also at the Department of Finance on a, I'd say it's a regular memo. We issue a memo after a bonding bill has been enacted, addressed to state agencies and local governments, just kind of laying out some of the fundamental steps that they need to remember to go through. That, in essence, that just because they got an appropriation in the bonding bill doesn't mean they're done. There are other things they may need to do, like submit a pre-design to the Department of Administration, and those things are all covered in the memo. I want to just take a minute here to talk about this top element on that slide, and then I'm going to stop talking and turn it over to Peter Salson. I just wanted to bring to your attention that for budgeting at finance, we build into the forecast an amount of funding to pay the debt service cost of an average size bonding bill. And the way we do that is we take an average of the even year bills over a 10-year period and include the amount of debt service needed to pay for that size bill in the forecast. Similar, we take an average of the odd year emergency bonding bills over that 10-year period and include the debt service for that in our forecast. So using that approach in our forecast, we have calculated an average size of $135 million bonding bill for 2007.
President Mahoney has a question.
When she's done.
Okay.
And $645 million for 2008. And that's the amount of debt service that's included in the forecast. As the bonding committee, you know, oftentimes the discussion will then turn to, well, I have a different size bonding package. What's the additional debt service cost of doing a larger bonding package than either one of those two numbers? And that's essentially a special sort of a fiscal note that finance will work with the fiscal analyst to get you that information. But as a starting point, those are the numbers that we work with.
Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so, you know, myself and the rest of the committee knows, are you factoring in inflation over those 10 years, or are you just taking the actual dollar figure from those years and not adjusting it for, you know, dollars a decade later?
Ms. Rackin. Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, no, we're just using the straight dollar amounts. And that's why I think over time you would consider this to be a moving average, where we would be dropping off the earlier bills and picking up later ones.
Madam Chair, if I was to ask you at some point to factor in inflation over those last 10 years and come up with that same number, you certainly would be able to do that, wouldn't you?
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Carlson?
Yeah. Madam Chair, when you're doing that projection, how do you handle the share of the debt service then in determining the size from the higher ed contribution?
Ms. Rankin.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, it depends on whether you're talking about the University of Minnesota or MNSCU. First of all, because they get treated differently in the bill, but in general, for MNSCU, I guess, is the cleanest example, that's included. I hedge a little bit on the University of Minnesota because the past few years, what we've tend to see in the bonding bills is because there's an expectation that they pay for one-third the cost of a building project. What happens in the bonding bill is that the state is only appropriating bonds, an amount for two-thirds of the cost of the project. And then there's a little rider in there that talks about there's an expectation that the university provides the rest of the funding from university sources. So they don't get treated the same in the bonding bills. And that's an area that I find I am always needing to qualify and make that distinction clear for folks.
I understand that they are treated differently, but just as a general rule, then, when you're giving us that average-sized bonding bill, in your calculations, you're including whatever their share is defined as, whether it's the U of M or Madam Chair, how about when you're calculating relative to the general requirement that we expect a local match when we're dealing with a local project? How is that calculated in?
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, the local match question would not come into play at all, because that is specifically actually thought of as non-state sources. And there's not, it would have to be a very unique circumstance for a project to be in the bonding bill for a local government where the state is paying the full cost and charging the debt and making the local government pay half of the cost of the debt service.
So, Madam Chair, you're saying that doesn't change the average projection in terms of when you're looking at it, what the ultimate size of a bonding bill could be, because there's a higher ed match or a local government match.
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's correct.
Thank you.
Does that conclude the...
Madam Chair, I didn't introduce myself earlier. I'm Peter Salzman from the Department of Finance. Let me just comment a little bit on this average capital budget and the problems it has created and continues to create as we present this to you. As you probably are aware, forecasts are based upon current law, but there is no current law for the size of future capital budgets. So back, and I've been doing this a long time now, back in the time of the Governor Carlson's administration, Governor Carlson was really making the decision on the size of the capital budget to include the debt service for, as we did the forecasting, and he liked capital budgets in the $700 million area. Then when he went out of office and Governor Ventura came in, Governor Ventura's office said, no, we don't like $700 million capital budgets, and they lowered it in the $400 million area. You know, arbitrary numbers based upon who was governor and a forecast, which was left us in the Department of Finance a little uncomfortable, because that's not the way we thought it should be done. So we went to this 10-year moving average of trying to take the last 10 years, even years and odd years, as a way of coming up with something that doesn't have this, you know, governor's office, the political taint to it. And this is what we've come up with. It's not perfect. People ask me, it's in here as a $645 million capital budget for 2008. If people would ask me, do I think that's the size of the capital budget in 2008? I'd say, no, it's not. I think it's going to be much bigger than that. But we've tried to find a way of making this a better number. And the problem that's created here, I didn't say that the problem that's created, is if the capital budget is in the forecast at $645 million and you want to do a $945 million capital budget, you've got to find the debt service for the other $300 million of bonds, which can become a problem for you as you go through your legislative process. So we understand it's not perfect, and we're willing to listen to suggestions on how to make it better.
Carlson, were you?
Yeah, I was there.
Representative Tinglestad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point then, Mr. Salzman, with this 10-year averaging, I'm wondering how you dealt with the anomaly in the 2003-2004 time frame when there was no big bonding bill, followed by 2 years where there were two big bonding bills. So does that sort of throw off the anomaly, or you have a separate set of 10-year averages for those?
Madam Chair and Representative Tingle said we sort of fudged. We took the 2005 capital budget and put it in 2004, so that we could have that big capital budget in that year. So that, you know, we played with the numbers.
We like to do less. No. We can too. Representative Singleton, was there for,
no,
and Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about emergency bonding, or what constitutes an emergency. Would say bonding that leverages federal dollars that disappear at the end of the year, is that an emergency?
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair and Representative, in a lot of ways, the definition of emergency is sort of in the eyes of the beholder. And I would say that stay tuned until Monday to find out what the governor's definition is, and we recognize that you may have a different definition of what an emergency is.
Like we might call a leaky roof an emergency. Was that your follow-up, Representative Holbert?
Madam Chair, and would the debt service for both of the 135 and the 645 be included now in the forecast of the November forecast? Are they included? Both years are included.
The amount of debt service set aside from the November forecast is the $135 million capital budget in the 07 session and $645 million in the 08 session.
And Madam Chair, my next question is then, in your 10-year averaging, when you put the big budget of 05 back into 04, then did you count 05 as zero?
I have to look for help.
Or did you fudge that too?
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, the Department of Finance consulted legislative staff.
I know they did.
And came to an agreement that basically what we did is we kept $135 million of the 05 bill assigned to 05, and we moved the rest of it back to 04.
Okay.
So we did actually have quite a few conversations about the different ways to do it before coming to a consensus of handling it that way.
Madam Chair, just one more quick question. Based on the 3% cap that we have as a self-imposed, 3% of our budget, our general fund budget, what would the size of the availability for bonding be? Is it about $900 and some million?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that's maximum debt capacity, and the maximum debt capacity calculation, which drives the 3% guideline number, 3% of general fund revenues for debt service, 2-3% would have a capital budget of $135 million in 07 and $975 million in 08, and then each of the even and odd numbered sessions in the future would have the same $135-975.
And, Madam Chair, just one other question then. If you have a larger bonding bill in 07, does that lower the debt capacity under that calculation in 08?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, it does.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, just one, does it lower it more or less? Because sometimes those bonding proposals are, you know, the first year is not very much of a bonding for debt capacity. I mean, the cost of it is not very much. Does it lower it? If I would take $75 million out of 08 and put it into 07, does it lower it the 08 by $75 million, or does it lower it by more?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I believe it lowers it by more.
Okay.
Representative Kelsey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I have a question, I believe, for Ms. Rankin. Back on page 16, where there's some of the parameters and the evaluations, on number two, where it says the project helps fulfill an important state mission. Is that mission defined somewhere, or does that change with administrations, or does that change with legislatures, or how would we be able to interpret that?
Ms. Rankin?
Madam Chair, Representative Scaldi, if it's defined somewhere, I'd love to know where it is, because it would make the evaluation job a lot easier. That, I think, is one of the challenges that I was thinking of when I was responding to Representative Wagenius's earlier question. Operationally, I think that you can look at what kind of activities state agencies are doing, where the legislature is appropriating money, and what kind of initiatives are being supported as an indication of state mission, but it is not anywhere close to being black and white, and it is, as I said, one of the challenges of this particular statute.
And I think we've noted, following up on Representative Wagenius's and now yours, that we'll figure out a way to revisit this page at a upcoming meeting for committee discussion to see whether we'd like to do something about that. If there are no further questions, we'll transition then. Were you concluding then, Ms. Rankin?
Yes.
Then we have a new handout for Mr. Sousen, debt management presentation. And I don't know if we have had copies of this, sufficient copies for the audience. If there's anyone who hasn't had this and wants it, you could let committee staff know. I'm not certain if we had additional copies of these.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Again, I'm Peter Sousen from the Department of Finance, and for the first time I've gone high-tech here doing these presentations using the computer and the screen, so I'm going to be probably more concerned about getting the technology right than what my presentation.
We have an expert in the room. He knows. In fact, he's told us, he sent us a little note saying that earlier issue we had is just one of those ongoing issues that we think is going to be repaired soon, but it hasn't. It hasn't upset us too much today. So, yeah. But anyway, he's available for you should you need him.
And we have from finance also someone who does these types of things. I want to introduce, though, Sue Barola, who's up in the front row. Sue, why don't you stand up, please? Sue works with me, and she's behind the scenes, but provides a lot of information to the House Capital Investment Committee in the capital budget process. Over the years, Sue has developed a debt management model that can take the questions like Representative Solberg was just asking. If you take $75 million out of one year and you put it in another year, what happens? And your staff over the years has come to rely upon Sue to give that type of information. And as you're contemplating a different size capital budget and you want to know what an $850 million capital budget would cost, staff has called Sue and Sue has provided the information to you. So this is an important person in the capital budget process, and I wanted to introduce her to the committee and acknowledge all the good work that she does for this committee.
Thank you.
If you go to page 2 of the presentation, that's the cover page from our last general obligation bond sale. Bonds sold to finance projects approved by the legislature, mainly in 2005 and 2006, although there are projects from earlier years that are also funded. And also, in part of this, is the trunk highway bond sold for improvements to the trunk highway system, mainly from the 2003 $400 million bonding authorization for trunk highways. As the legislature passes the bill, it's up to us in the Department of Finance to provide the bond funds to pay for the cost of the bonding bills. So we go out in the marketplace and sell bonds. This is the cover page to our official statement, and I have an actual official statement, a couple of them, of them, and maybe the page could just, you know, somebody could help, but just pass it on and take a look at it. This is a legal document that we're required to prepare to provide the marketplace with everything they need to know about the state of Minnesota to make a decision whether or not to invest in our bonds. We are highly rated bonds. I get into ratings later on. We're AA1 from Moody's and AAA from Standard & Poor's and Fitch, which are very highly rated bonds. But we still have to provide information on not only now, but on an ongoing basis. As long as these bonds are outstanding, we have to provide information to the marketplace so investors can make the decisions on buying or selling of our bonds. In the middle of the page, you can see that all of the 20 years of bond maturities, the state's constitution limits the bonds we sell to a maximum maturity of 20 years, and the amount of principal that we pay each of those 20 years, and interest rates are also shown there. Below the table, there's the breakdown of how many dollars went for capital projects that would come through this committee and the dollars that go to the trunk highway bonds. From the sale, there were $73 million. Of bond proceeds used to fund the trunk highway projects. And just to say that this was the second sale we had in the fall of 2006. The first sale was a $345 million bond sale that we held with the closing date of August 1. The closing date on this bond sale was November 1, and we needed this amount of bonds. We sold bonds in an amount that we feel will meet all the cash needs of all the capital projects until about August 1 of 2007. I can say that as I track it every day, we are spending a lot of money on projects. The 2005 projects are moving forward very quickly and spending the bond proceeds to get the projects built. And the 2006 are a little slower, I would guess, because the people responsible have the 2005 projects to get started, but the 2006 projects are now picking up and spending the bond proceeds, and those projects are well underway. So I wanted to show you this as an example of what we have to do to get the bonds out there and get the bonds sold. And the official statement is going around, and you can take a look at that.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sousen, will you at some future time tell us about how you pay off the bonds? You know, we pay them off quicker.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, I have a little comments on that. We have a rapid repayment of the debt. You just look at the principal payments that are on this cover sheet. You can see that we have more principal in the early years than the later years. That is to meet one of our debt guidelines. We don't sell bonds like you find in your home mortgage, where you pay the same amount and each month the amount of principal and interest changes. We start out our process here with the same amount of principal paid every year and then make adjustments to it, but it's a rapid repayment of debt so that we limit the interest costs over the lifetime of a bond issue.
You were Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was intrigued by the statement that Mr. Salson just made about the 2005 things moving pretty fast, but the 2006 projects a little bit slower, probably because of the backup of two big years. And I think that's really an important item to note that, I was on this committee in 2003 and 2004 when there were those stalemates, and I heard from constituents, other people around the state that, there's sort of this every other year there's a big bonding bill process, and people gear up for that. And that year there were a lot of layoffs, and I think the bonding bill in a lot of ways affects a lot of things in the economy. And to then hear, with two big bonding bills in the last biennium, that they can't both move quickly. So there was almost like a pent-up need, and they can't move sort of the normal rate that they would have moved over the last 4 years had there been a normal every other year big bonding bill. So I think sometimes, if we look at some legislative process through the years, that we don't always understand the repercussions of our actions here and some of the long-lasting things that we do that affect other things around the state. So I just think it's an important item to note, just some of the repercussions from that 2004 year.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Selson. Just wondering how often are bonds that are authorized by the legislature not issued?
Mr. Selson.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, you're going to see the cancellation report when we come back on Tuesday, and there's a certain projects in the cancellation report. It's a report the Commissioner of Finance made on January 1 of this year of bond balances that are over 4 years old and for which there are no commitments. So you're going to see a small amount of dollars in there. Every bonding bill has some amount that never gets sold because the projects never get started. The projects come in at a lower cost. Maybe it's a program run by the PFA or the DNR where all the money isn't allocated. But for the most part, almost all the projects start and almost all the bond proceeds are used.
Okay, thank you.
Representative
Solberg. Sure, just out of curiosity, as I looked at the list of payments, we see that in 2010 there's a jump of all the rest of them are even. Why is there in this particular one a jump?
Mr. Sousa.
Well, Chairman, Representative Solberg, those are bonds sold for the Rural Finance Authority. In the sale, we sold $4.5 million of general obligation bonds to be used by the Rural Finance Authority to participate in loans for the beginning farmer programs. They want their maturities to all be in 1 year. So they picked 2010 as the year they want all their maturities, and they change that every once in a while based upon loan repayments. But that is the rejump set.
Oh, okay.
Continue.
I'm on page 3, and I think I have to get to page 3. And this is what is a bond? Now, I might be talking about bonds and bonding, but I just left to put a definition here on what is a bond. I don't think I'm going to read it, but one of the highlights of my presentations in the past, and the members who have heard me do this before, I've seen this before, but I've got some old state bonds here that I'm going to put down. This is a bearer bond. Bonds were issued. This is a specimen, by the way. This isn't no good anymore. But these were bonds that were issued in 1978. And this is a $5,000 denomination over here. This is the principal amount of bond of $5,000. And on the right side, you'll find a whole bunch of coupons. Starting in July 1978, the holder of the bond could have clipped a coupon and got $125. And then 6 months later, got another $125. And these were trunk highway bonds. And if you look at it, when you look at it, you'll see that there's no names on it. That's why it's a bearer bond. Whoever holds it owns it. The bearer of the bond owns it.
One of the interesting things is that there's signatures at the bottom of this. One is Gerald Christensen, who was Commissioner of Finance at the time. The other one is the State Treasurer, which is blank on this specimen because there had to be an original signature. And at the time, the State Treasurer traveled to New York City to, I think, a company called the Signature Company, and it would have a pen that was like this, and there would be 30 of these bonds that were fed into a machine, and the State Treasurer would sign his name, and it would appear on 30 bonds, and then the people at the Signature Company would pull that out, put in 30 more bonds. It was an all-day process of getting these bonds legally signed with a signature. The State Treasurer's office also had to redeem all these coupons. And they had, at the time, 1.5 staff people assigned full-time just to process these coupons as they came back to the state. Not a very efficient way of doing business in today's world. And since our debt outstanding today may be 8 times what it was when these bonds were last issued, there'd probably be maybe 5 or 6 or 7 people who would have a full-time job today just trying to process all these coupons that came back to the banking system and properly account for them. About 1985, the federal government told state and local governments that issued bearer bonds that we couldn't issue bearer bonds anymore. They did it for 2 reasons. One, inheritance taxes. The people who owned these bonds could put them in a safety deposit box, and for the state taxes and inheritance taxes, the government never knew about it. And the second was drug money. Drug money, people who were in the drug business needed a place to launder money without their names on it. These were bearer bonds, their names weren't on it, so the federal government, wanting to close that little thing down, required the state and local government issues to issue certified bonds. And maybe if you can occupy about this. In about 1985, we were required to issue bonds in registered form, and although this is a specimen, again, and not filled in, if it was filled in, it would be the name of the owner would be on here several times. The dollar amount would be on here. The bond I'm passing around is a $5,000 bond. It would have $5,000. I should add on those, they were all $5,000. So if you bought $1 million worth of bonds, if a mutual fund bought $1 million worth of bonds, they'd get $1 million divided by 5,000 is the number of bonds they actually had to deal with in store somewhere. So this was a certificate for registered bonds beginning about 1985. And then in the late 1980s, we stopped issuing even certificates. Now it's just a handshake and we say thank you for buying our bonds, and it's all done by brokers and computers. So that's what a bond looks like, and I hope everybody enjoys them. I'd like them back after the meeting.
Representative Peterson. Madam Chair, I almost hate to admit this, but I came out of college with a degree in economics, went to work for a big banking corporation called Northwest Bank Corporation out of Minneapolis, and I got called into the bank, and about 4 times a year, they'd keep us all night long down the vault as we clipped those coupons for customers and then batch them and send them in. It was absolutely ridiculous. And I thought it was really important, though.
My recollection at the time is there are other people with jobs like myself that I have in other states and local governments who protested the federal government requiring us to issue them other than in bearer form. And that's so inefficient. It's so time-intensive to do all this clipping that today just using computers is just a marvelous way of doing business, and we at the state save a lot of money in not having to administer all those coupons. Page 4, there are many types of bonds. I've got them listed here. The ones that we're interested in are the municipal bonds. The state sells its state bonds into the municipal bond market, even if we are not a municipality. As I say on page 5, we issue tax-exempt bonds. There are over 15,000 different issuers of tax-exempt state and local government bonds. A generalization is that bonds that are sold for public purposes, such as the projects that you approve here, are generally general obligations of the issuers, although not always. And bonds sold for private purposes are usually revenue bonds. There are bonds, tax-exempt bonds, sold by state and local governments that are used for private purposes. Within the state of Minnesota, the Housing Finance Agency sells revenue bonds, uses the proceeds for first-time mortgages to homeowners. That's a private use. The homeowners in the home is a private use. There are industrial revenue bonds that are sold by the Agricultural and Economic Development Board that are for private purposes. And those are, again, those are basically revenue bonds. I've talked a couple of times here and said the tax-exempt bonds, the state sells tax-exempt bonds, and the federal government regulates the issuance of tax-exempt bonds. They have regulations that we have to follow. If you look in the official statements, you'll find the lawyers all certified that we're following all those laws. A couple of the things that I have talked about in the past and I expect to talk about in the future are the arbitrage regulations, that limit the ability of state and local governments to sell bonds and use the proceeds and make a profit by investing the money. When we sell bonds, when the Commissioner of Finance sells bonds for the state, the Commissioner has to sign a certificate that says we have a purpose, a real public purpose for using those bond proceeds, and that they will be spent within a certain period of time, because in the past there were issuers who would sell bonds at a tax-exempt rate, be able to invest the bonds at a higher taxable rate and make a profit, and there were bonds sold at, by some local governments, never anybody in Minnesota, I know, for the sole purpose of trying to make a profit on the arbitrage between a tax-exempt bond and a taxable bond. But the second one that we've encountered in our process here from time to time are reimbursement bonds. Sometimes there is a local project, that a legislator may submit to the legislative process, where the local government is looking to be reimbursed from bond proceeds for expenditures they've already made. And my response when somebody asks me whether they can do that is highly, highly unlikely that the state can use its tax-exempt bonds to reimburse a local government for expenditures that they have made in the past. So if you ever encounter a project, somebody in your district is looking for the state to do that, they need to talk to me first, because I think I understand the basics of the regulations to determine whether or not we can do it, but most likely we cannot do it.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sellison, on county state aid highway bonds, a lot of times the county will sell them. Is there a period before it's considered arbitrage?
Well, Mr. Sellison, Madam Chair and Representative Peter, if the local government's selling these bonds, they can make certain declarations to say that they plan to use to reimburse the money from another source, and be within the regulations. But as far as the spend down and the arbitrage regulations, we say that we will spend all of the bond proceeds within 2 years. So the $400 million that you saw on the cover, from the cover page of our official statement, we have to spend all $400 million within a two-year period. And we have done that with all of our bond sales except one maybe 15 years ago where there was maybe $60,000 unspent at the end of the two-year period. If we don't do it, then we have to pay penalties to the federal government for not meeting the arbitrage regulations. I've listed here, as I said,
if you see, by the way, a logical cutoff, we have just about 5 minutes left, so if it's this or if it's the next
page. This
page
will be my last
page, okay.
Madam Chair, because
okay.
I think that is a logical cutoff.
And then we'll introduce our last three members.
And on this page, I just listed all the different state issuers that issue bonds. And at the top, I have the Commissioner of Finance, who sells general obligation various purpose bonds and general obligation trunk highway bonds. Sometimes I hear them talking about trunk highway that they're not general obligation bonds, but the trunk highway bonds sold by the state are also general obligation bonds. And I just noted in here that the Commissioner of Finance in the fall of 2006 sold 911 revenue bonds as authorized by the legislature for the build-out of the 911 system in the St. Cloud and Rochester area. I'm not going to go through the rest of the listings. If anybody has any question on what the other purposes are, I will try to answer those questions.
And a question, Representative Riccolino.
Mr. Sullivan, you know, I got a banker friend that irritates him that bonds are tax-exempt, municipal bonds, and he actually is a banker that thinks people that got money that should pay taxes. So the history behind the fact, you know, that bonds are tax exempt? Was it to be able to sell them? Were they risky projects? What was it?
I'm Chair and Representative Rubin. I think it's a legal issue of between the federal government and the state government, where the state cannot tax the interest on federal bonds, the U.S. government bonds, and the U.S. government can't tax the interest on state bonds. I think there's a legal doctrine in there that I know very little about, but I think it comes from that, not from any decision that there should be tax-exempt interest
for people who can afford tax, afford to buy bond.
So, Madam Chair,
Member Covino,
and Mr. Stelson, so, I mean, I don't know if I've ever bought a tax-exempt bond. I know people that have. I don't have the money to, but is there some history as to who, you know, the incomes of people or that buy tax-exempt bonds? And, I mean, is it the guy making a minimum wage that's buying a tax-exempt bond? Or
Madam Chair and Representative, I've never seen anything like that. I would guess that the, someone making minimum wage wouldn't buy a tax-exempt bond. They'd be better off if the tax bracket to buy a taxable bond. A lot. We also don't know who buys our bonds because of the way there's computers and so on today. But I know that many of our bonds are bought by insurance companies. Our bonds are bought by mutual funds who have individual investors who invest in mutual funds. But I don't know. I've never seen any information I'm aware of as to tax income brackets and buying tax exempt bonds.
Representative Peterson.
It's a quick question. Now, on these state bond issuers, Minnesota Office of Higher Ed, your department physically does the work to issue it, and it comes out as a bond for that department. They don't actually go through the bond underwriting themselves.
Madam Chairman, Representative Peterson, no, they do all the work themselves. The Department of Finance is not involved in the sale of these bonds.
They do their own underwriting.
They have
a consultant that does it for them.
This presentation is going to be concluded at next Tuesday meeting, January 23rd. At that same meeting, we'll get a report on bond cancellations. I don't believe there's anything controversial on that list, but for your information. And at that same meeting, we'll have an update from DNR Commissioner Mark Holston on the Minnesota Forest Legacy Partnership. He wants to give information to us about a change in a project or program. He's not asking for language or money, but information, and so we have him on the agenda. And we have three new members who've just joined us, or not just joined us, but who've been with us that didn't have an opportunity to introduce yourselves by district and perhaps previous role on the committee. We'll start with you.
I'm Al Junkie, representative from 13B, Candiota County, Wilmer. My goal has always been to just bring home as much money as Representative Rukavina to the Iron Range.
And that's an introduction to Representative Rukavina.
I'm Representative Tom Rukavina from District 5A on the Iron Range, and I, in my entire 21 years here, have not brought as much money home, and I got $100 on it that you did last year.
Uh-huh. Representative Murphy.
I'm Mary Murphy. I represent District 16, which is south of town district, and just north of Hinkley.
And I have had some wonderful individual visits with members, and a few more of you have called. They've been very helpful to talk about your own goals about the committee and perhaps in your local area. If anyone wants to schedule who has not yet, just please call us, and we're happy to schedule some time. I think we've got at least one or two still coming up. And I mentioned earlier, always check the room number, because if our meeting is going to be televised, it will be in another room. So it's just one of those things to be aware of. And with those announcements, meeting is adjourned.